Kirsten, you can unmute.
Hello, and welcome to the Beacon Group's Noon Step Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Kirsten, and I'm an alcoholic. In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speakers, you will not be able to unmute yourself during the meeting. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend, but we ask that only alcoholics participate. If you are new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we strongly recommend home group membership and sponsorship. If you are new or not so new or looking for a sponsor, please put your name and number in the chat. If you have worked all 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, have had a spiritual experience, and are willing to sponsor, please also put your name and number in the chat. The chat will remain open during the meeting, except while the speaker is sharing. If you're looking for a home group, we would love to have you. Our business meetings are on the third Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. on Zoom. To sign up for membership and to be on the email list, please visit our website, which is posted in the chat. Our website has a lot of great information as well as the recordings of our meetings. Also in the chat, you will find our AA quote of the day. The quote source will always be from our AA literature. Our speaker today will share for 30 minutes on the step of the day, and then we automatically split into breakout rooms for small group discussions. Each group has a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. When you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussions end at 12:53, followed by day counts, announcements, and the Lord's Prayer. We have asked Robert D. to read the 12 steps.
Robert, alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Robert. Today we will hear a talk on steps 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and steps 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Please give a warm welcome to Spencer D. from Novato, California. Welcome.
Hey everyone, my name is Spencer. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome if you're new. I hope you found here what I found here. It's a solution to a disease I didn't have, the disease of alcoholism. I thought, alcohol abuse is my problem. And I remember I walked into what is now my home group, the Midnight Men Stag in Tiburon, and it's about a group of about 120, 150 guys. And, those guys are armed with facts about alcoholism, and they could effectively carry the message of the 12 steps and a spiritual solution. But, you know, at the time I remember, my first meeting, I raised my hand and, you know, I don't know about your home group, but in my home group, you raise your hand, you got to be prepared to get a semicircle of men surrounding you, you know, and they cornered me. And, you know, the beauty about that is, you know, I was so unwelcome everywhere I went. And I found these guys, like 12 guys just smiling at me. And, you know, they asked me, you know, when's your next meeting? Do you have a meeting schedule? Do you have a big book? You want to come to coffee with us? And I said yes to coffee. And I remember that was probably the best decision I had made in my life up until that point. I said yes. And they sat me down and they started talking about the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, they talked about the doctor's opinion and the three parts of our disease, that I have this alcoholic mind, this mental obsession that, you know, I'm going to take a drink. And if I'm an alcoholic, it's not if I'm going to drink again, it's when I'm going to drink again. And, you know, and I have this allergy that separates me from the normal person, that once I take a drink, it's on. And they talk about this thing called spiritual malady. And, you know, I didn't know what they were talking about at the time, but, you know, they pointed to, you know, being restless, irritable, and discontent. I was uncomfortable in my own skin and I could identify with that. And they pointed to the devilments on page 52. And, you know, I could identify with all those. You know, they said, Spencer, this is what untreated alcoholism looks like. This is with or without a drink in your body. And they got me just to buy in just enough and to believe that I had their problem, that I believed in their solution. So again, if you're new, I hope you find that. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I definitely, you know, I've worked the 12 steps. I have a sponsor. He's keenly aware. He's my sponsor. I'm current with him. I'm current with him in my inventories. You know, my friend Marcelo was on this call. He said it perfectly. You know, steps 4 and 5 are my training wheels, you know, to learn how to do an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous. And step 10 is what I do to stay current with those training wheels. And they get to come off and I get to, you know, inventory, you know, resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear, and those things I learned about in my 4-step inventory. You know, he's current with him, and I'm honest and fully honest. And it wasn't always the case, but that's how I am today. And I sponsor men. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I need to. They kind of keep me from myself. And, you know, it's the only thing that's ever been asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous is to help another man. And I take that very seriously. And, you know, I also take helping another man very seriously by participating in service. I also have service commitments. I have service commitments above meeting level because I believe in upholding the traditions and upholding the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's important to participate in that in my recovery as well. And, you know, again, like I said, I had a home group, and I don't mention these things to tell you how, you know, great my program is. I want to let you know I'm not sober by accident, and I was separated from alcohol on March 1st, 2008. And I don't want to leave you guys with the impression that, you know, I got sober. It was a loving higher power separated me from alcohol that day. I wouldn't have said that at the time, but I now know that was the case. And so, yeah, it was Alcoholics Anonymous to save my life. I like to touch a little bit on my story because you'll see that the life I had led up until the point I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had some stuff that I needed to get out and some stuff I needed to put down on paper and get honest with another man and God about. My childhood was an absolute mess. I grew up in a home where both my parents were heroin addicts, and it was utter chaos from the beginning. And, you know, I learned a lot about fear growing up in that home. And I was constantly anxious, constantly fear-ridden, because the truth of the matter is, you know, I had two parents who were completely incapable of taking care of a child. You know, my mom got pregnant and here I was, and, you know, they just weren't present. And so I was constantly in fear. There was no adult supervision. I kind of had to fend for myself, and, you know, I was terrified. And so I kind of carried that through my adult years. I was constantly had this low level of anxiety in everything I did and every interaction I had. It was always living in this space between my ears and just wondering if I'm okay. And, you know, and it was rough. I saw a lot of things that a child shouldn't see, you know, and God bless them. My parents let me down, but I've been able to forgive them. There was a lot of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse in that home. And, you know, and it's something that I never thought I would talk about at a group level, but by doing a 4th and a 5th step inventory and not getting a disgusted reaction from my sponsor at the time and seeing that it helps other people, like I can get honest about that. And I can just report that that's okay because I've recovered from that childhood through the 12 steps. And, you know, and it was one of those things where my mom went to a treatment facility when I was 5 years old and, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, gave me my mom back. My dad decided he didn't want to get sober, but, you know, I loved AA before I ever walked in the door because you guys gave me a stable, loving home before I even knew I needed it. And, you know, at the time I went and lived with my aunt and uncle. So I went from living with heroin addict parents to fundamentalist Christians. And I have nothing against fundamentalist Christians, but there was an abrupt change. And again, just a ton of fear because I felt like these people, like I was this like feral 5-year-old child. And these people were so sweet and loving and kind and paid attention to me. And I just felt like a burden on them. But those people saved my life and I love them to death still to this day. And, you know, by the time I was ready to take my first drink, I was ready at 12 years old, you know, and I stole E&J Brandy and Gilby's gin and it was mixed them up and it was not a tasty treat. But by that point, like I needed the effect produced by alcohol. I needed that. Like I said, that anxiety and fear just kind of hit a dull roar. And by the time I, you know, hit that first drink at 12 years old, I was ready. And I blacked out the first time I took a drink and woke up outdoors underneath a giant trampoline. And, you know, it was beautiful. I walked into my buddy's parents' house that I was sleeping at. And I got that disgusted look for the first time. And, you know, I punched his little brother in the face, broke things around the house. And I was told that I was no longer welcome there. And that was not the first time or the last time that I was told that I was no longer welcome someplace, especially due to my drinking. And so, you know, I went to high school. I went to a private Catholic high school, very affluent where I live. Again, just felt different. I was terrified to go to the school. You know, I remember sitting in ceramics class and this girl was telling me that she told her dad she didn't want a Range Rover. She wanted a BMW. And I'm driving a 71 Dodge Dart that has no interior, no paint job. And my friends dubbed it the sex offender and then told me my car belonged on Unsolved Mysteries. And so I just felt different. And, you know, my drinking took off in high school. I paid a lot of legal consequences and, you know, but again, I spun that victim narrative that, you know, it's not my fault. It's a local police department. They have nothing else better to do than to bust teenagers. And, you know, and my behavior is excused because I did well in school. I excelled at sports and, you know, my parents and the adults around me excused my behavior because I did well in those two things. And I got to college and it was more of the same. I went to a school down in Southern California where I was able to play sports. You know, my school was paid for, but I did a lot of reward drinking down there. It was something that, you know, come Saturday night after practice and after the game, I aimed for oblivion. And, you know, I would get a 12 pack or a fifth and have to drink before I went out. And, you know, if you have to drink to go out drinking, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that was an abnormal relationship with alcohol until I got here, but apparently it is. And, you know, and so I got through college. Again, the San Luis Obispo Police Department knew me by my first name, but again, not my fault. You know, it's one of those things where slow PD does nothing. It's nothing better than bus college kids. And, you know, I got out of college and my mom called me and she had raised me a single mom. She was my absolute hero. And she told me that she had contracted hepatitis C through IV drug use and her liver is failing and she was in full blown cirrhosis. And I was 22 years old and she asked me to come home and take care of her. And so, of course I did. And, you know, that was a really brutal year and a half of my life. I watched my mom suffer and die. You know, and my drinking really took off at that point. I began drinking around the clock. At the time I met this woman that was to kind of be the Bonnie to my Clyde. And I remember I tell the story cause I'll let you know that, I'm concentrating today on fear and sex. And I remember on our third date, we went to a nightclub and a bouncer tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Sir, did you walk in here, the blonde?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come with me." And so he took me to the women's bathroom and he opens up the door and this girl that I had taken on a date has a woman's head and she's slamming her face into the mirror and screaming, you know, screaming obscenities at her. And I just shrugged my shoulder, slung her over my shoulder and moved in with her a week later. So I had very, very high standards for what I brought into my life. Very, very discerning about the opposite sex. And so, you know, I definitely needed not only an inventory beyond, you know, drinking, but I needed an overhaul in that area of my life as well. And so my, you know, my drinking got bleak, my life got small. And, you know, it was one of those things where the scariest part of alcoholism for me is when I walked into AA, the beauty, you guys explained to me why I could not pick up the first drink. And that's what terrified me, is I had many days where I had sincere desire to not drink that day. And by 2 o'clock, I was blacked out drunk. And I couldn't understand why. And I thought I was just broken and it was going to be this way and I was going to die an alcoholic death. And, you know, I went to a 28-day treatment facility and, you know, they got me physically well enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember I got out of that treatment facility and I went to this meeting and there was this guy talking and he was 5 years sober. He was on fire in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a collegiate athlete and he was telling my story. And, you know, like I said, he was armed with facts about himself and he knew what he was talking about. And I asked him to be my sponsor that day. And, you know, he said, my job, Spencer, is to keep me in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when we get to a step, we're going to work it. And, you know, I remember when we got into the book and, you know, we read those few pages and I got to learn about alcoholism. I got an education in it. So when I took that first step on page 30, I knew what I was admitting to in my innermost self and, you know, and that I was powerless and, you know, my life was unmanageable. And, you know, he said, Spencer, you know, you've identified the problem, but, you know, the solution, your spiritual journey begins in step two. And I needed something bigger than myself to get between me and that insane thought precedes the first drink. And so, you know, my second step simply looked like I was willing enough to pray on a daily basis and ask whatever it is I was praying to, and I didn't believe much at the time, to keep me sober that day and to direct my thinking. And if I stayed sober, I said, thank you. And that was the beginning of my spiritual journey. And, you know, by the time I got to a third step, you know, I was just willing to concede those first two propositions and I was willing to do the work in steps 4 through 9. And by the time I got to a fourth step, you know, I was really grateful that my sponsor at the time, he said, Spencer, you know, this is just a writing assignment and it's just an inventory. You know, it's a fact finding and fact facing, you know, proposition. And so I don't need to put in a bunch of emotion behind it. I don't need to go write a novel. You know, he was very clear. He's all just writing bullet points. And I was like, well, don't you need to know what happened? He said, Spencer, you're going to be there. You're going to be doing the talking. And so, you know, and I got, you know, I started writing and we read through chapter 5 and, you know, and what struck me is that Bill uses really strong language in chapter 5. And I needed that, like an alcoholic like me, I needed that to get my attention. You know, resentment's the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. You know, any life run on resentment only leads to futility and happiness. And so we got to the fear portion and I noticed, you know, in the examples, in chapter 5, you know, fear had bracketed what some of those things affect, you know, like self-esteem is bracketed by fear, sex relations is bracketed by fear. And, you know, and the book talks about, you know, that little word affects all areas of our life. And that's been the absolute truth for me. It's like fear has been a soul sickness of mine since I was, you know, 3-4 years old. I was riddled with it. And, you know, it was something that, you know, it drove me. And, you know, when I wrote down how many fears I had, I was just astonished. I remember I had like 3 pages of fears and, you know, they could all fit into the same categories. You know, I'm not going to get what I want. I'm going to lose what I already have. You know, you're not going to like me. You're going to judge me. I'm not enough and I'm not lovable. You know, they all fall into that, but I've got them all down, you know, and I needed to put their, and I was under the impression I was a big, tough guy. I'm like, I'm big in stature. You know, I intimidate people physically, but it's like, I am just fearful of everything and everyone, and I'm uncomfortable. And, you know, I love the book talks about, you know, it's that evil and corrosive thread that runs through my life. And my sponsor is a big dictionary guy. So he had me look up the word corrosive, and it's to destroy or weaken gradually. And so what that is, living with that fear, it just destroyed the fabric of my existence gradually. Slowly but surely, I became spiritually sick. You know, in the book, it talks about, you know, why did I have these fears? And it talks about, it was because self-reliance had failed me. You know, and self-reliance for me is, it looks like pride and ego and all those nasty things about my character. And the thing about, my sponsor talked about in my fifth step, is that self-centered fear is a chief activator of my character defects. He explained it to me kind of like a boiling pot of water. Like my, you know, fear is the fire underneath this boiling pot of water. I'm the boiling pot of water, and the steam coming off is all the character defects that get inflamed when I'm in fear. And so, you know, I think in the fear portion of chapter five, it's the first time I kind of get challenged on my third step decision, right? It's, can I be God reliant and rely on infinite God rather than finite self, or continue to live in self-reliance and probably get drunk? And it's funny. It's like, that question is like, relying on infinite God or finite self is like, it's one of those funny, like, questions for an alcoholic, right? It's like early in the book, it talks about, you know, we blot ourselves off to an alcoholic death or accept spiritual help. And it's like, an alcoholic, like, that's a real decision. It's like, can I get back to you on that? And it's like, you know, I have this loving infinite higher power. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I can't live with, can't live fear, but I can't live without it either. Cause I don't know, I'm unable to handle it, and I have to give it up to God. And, it's one of those things where, you know, I have to think about who God would have me be in a situation. And when I talked about fear rather than who I think I need to be, it's, my first sponsor was great. And it's something I still use today. When I'm in fear, I ask God to relieve the fear I'm having. And then I ask and meditate myself, who is God having me be in the situation? You know, if I'm interacting with my partner, I think to myself, like, what would a loving partner look like right now? You know, would it be, you know, kind, compassionate, a good listener? If it's a problem and I'm having fear, it, you know, at my job, I consider what a good employee would look like in the situation. You know, am I going to show up on time? Am I honest? Am I doing my job throughout the day? And, you know, that's really helped me. It kind of focuses me on spiritual principles and focuses me on, because the problem begins with me when I start to play God, right? When I begin to try to play God in my life, in situations, I get into trouble. And that's when unmanageability kicks in. And so if I can play the role God assigns me and get outside of that self-reliance experiment, you know, I'll try that again and again. But the good news for me is, again, I have that 10-step inventory that, you know, I get to see on a daily basis where I stepped away from that third step decision. You know, and I love on page 68, right, it talks about now about sex. And that, you know, that always got my attention, right? When I got to there, it's like, it's funny, when I read with guys, I either get a groan at that point, or I get an excited, you know, eye-opening look. And the truth is, you know, we wouldn't, like I said, we wouldn't be human if we didn't have problems with sex. And, you know, and doing that sex inventory has really helped me with, you know, with judgment surrounding that area of people's lives. And I realize I'm not the arbiter of anyone's sex life. I get to sponsor them just through anything. And I remember I was delusional and I thought I was a good guy. Right. I think some of us, you know, when we come to that fourth and that fifth step, the chunks of truth we swallow, at least for me, were I'm neither as bad nor as good in these areas than I thought I was. Right. It's somewhere in the middle. And it's like, I get to learn about how I really was in those situations. And, you know, in that realm of my life, there was a ton of character defects and a ton of dishonesty. And when I got down, you know, to brass tacks and wrote these things out, I was extremely self-centered. You know, what I did is I was a serial monogamist. I would destroy the relationship. And then in between, I would just use women to treat the feelings I had from the breakup. And then I would trick somebody else into getting, you know, back together with me, you know. And it was, you know, it talks about, you know, did I unjustifiably arouse, you know, suspicion, jealousy, or, you know, bitterness? And it was like, yes, yes, and yes. And, you know, the book was written in 1939, but, you know, my sponsor said, he's all, Spencer, this is called playing games. You play games with people. and, you know, and you use people and you cause drama. And he said, you're a drama queen. I remember hearing that and I was like, you know, deeply offended, but he was right. Like I was a drama queen. I caused drama so I could feel a little bit of superiority. And, you know, when it was something that, what I saw on those pages was somebody that if I were dating my, you know, if someone was dating my sister or my mom, I would want to hurt that person. And that was kind of, it kind of stuck with me that I was nowhere near the guy I thought I was and who I wanted to be in that. And I think the biggest value for me coming out of that sex inventory is my sponsor had me write a sane and sound sex ideal for myself. And I think, you know, a lot of people, when I've talked to them after they're done with their fist step with another guy, and it's not judgment, but a lot of people don't do that. And I think it's plain as day. It says to do that in our literature. And it was so important for me to write down who I wanted to be in a relationship, the man I wanted to be, to set some ideals for myself, because I'd never considered that before in my life. And I got to write down some things about who I wanted to be with, the woman I wanted to be around. But he made it clear that unless I was willing to grow towards being that guy, I was not going to attract that woman. And he's been absolutely right. And the inverse has been true for me in sobriety. If I stop growing towards that ideal, I lose her. And, you know, and that's something that, you know, for me has been really important. And, you know, and it's something that I, when I'm struggling in a romantic relationship or struggling in the sex portion of my life, I go back to that list. I go back to that inventory and decide, you know, am I living as that guy? Am I moving towards that ideal or am I moving away from it? You know, I love the book, you know, and it's something, the way I look through sex is simply, is it selfish, right? You know, because it's easy to kind of, everyone's different about those things. But when I sponsor guys or I look through my own, you know, sex and romantic life, I distill it through this. Is it selfish? You know, and it's not always cut and dry. And, you know, I have things like infidelity in my sobriety, and that's clear cut. That is selfish, and that's something that's wrong. And, but, you know, I'll share this story. It was funny. I was dating before I had my current partner, and I was out on a date with a woman. She was a single mom. And, you know, I had this ideal for myself that I wasn't going to sleep with anybody unless I'd hung out with them, been on 5 dates with them. That was my, you know, hard, fast rule. I needed to know the person. And we're on like date 3, and I'm hitting her with my spiel, right? I'm like, oh, we're not doing anything. You're not coming up. There are 5 dates, blah, blah, blah. And she looked at me and she said, Spencer, that's great. And I really appreciate the fact you're trying to do something like that. But I paid over $120 for a babysitter tonight for a reason, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and it was something that, you know, and we went upstairs, and it was something that I talked to my sponsor about, because I felt I failed. And he was like, no, Spencer, like, two adults laid their cards out on the table and you guys made a consensual adult decision. And that's not selfish. And so it's like, I have to look through every situation through that prism. Is how am I interacting? What are my motives? You know, and I think that's really important in the sexual realm, is like, what are my motives and is it selfish? And I was talking to a sponsee yesterday, and we were talking about his dating life, and he started talking about things. And I just said, hey man, what do you think? Is that selfish? You know, you're not being honest with these women. And he's like, yeah, you're right. And I don't have to give him comment on counsel on the whole situation and tell him he's doing it wrong, or the way he's dating, or how many women he's dating. Like, that's not my lane, you know, but I get to say, hey, you know, like, that sounds pretty selfish. Maybe you should have some conversations. And, you know, and I think that it's important to talk about the fact that, you know, the end of chapter 5 in the sex realm is one of the few times it says, if I'm not willing to adjust my behavior in an area of my life, I'm sure to drink. And, you know, and I always make mention of that with guys, because it says, you know, if I'm not willing to learn and I'm not sorry, I'm going to get drunk in this area of my life. And that's a pretty stern warning. And, you know, when I got honest about this stuff with another man, again, I received no judgment. And, you know, and that was such a freeing experience. I felt free afterwards. And, you know, in these areas and the other steps, you know, it's one of those things where I think for me personally, you know, I had to look at my character defects surrounding this sexual area. I mean, I've had to look at my relationship with validation and validation from the opposite sex, validation in a relationship. And I've had to really, in some of these defects, have hit rock bottom levels. I made a lot of unreasonable demands of the world around me, and I made a lot of other unreasonable demands of my partners, especially in the bedroom. And that came up in my current relationship, and it almost ended it. But the gift is I had tools here. I was able to practice 6 and 7, do regular inventories, and then I wanted to be different. And this is not me, but you know, I remember my partner a couple of months ago looked at me and said, "Thank you so much that those things don't come up in our relationship. I'm glad you did the work." And you know, those 9-step amends surrounding the sex portion of my inventory were a little dicey, right? You know, because a lot of it, I wanted to go back to all my exes and tell them how wonderful I was doing. And you know, and it was made clear that, you know, under no circumstances would I be doing that. And in some of those, I was able to talk to some of the women that I still had contact with and let them know that they deserve better than what I gave them and kept it simple with that. And so, you know, and it's still, like I said, what I learned in that initial inventory, I still carry with me today. And, you know, like, again, I still look at that ideal for myself. I still look at the ideal I have for my partner. I think that's important to constantly check in with that. You know, for me, I have to stay current with fear, selfish dishonesty, and resentment, because for me, like, I can't have a clear 11-step practice if I'm going to hold myself. I just can't. This alcohol can't do that. And unless I'm clear, a clear channel has an opening on both ends. And if I'm blocked with self, it's hard to even be a channel of God's love and grace if I'm constantly trying to manage and control those things myself. And, you know, when I do that, I can match calamity with serenity, you know, and when I don't, I can't. And, you know, a couple examples, it's like, you know, I mean, I remember I've been in the hospital when they were telling me that I had a staph infection in my right leg, and they said they might take my leg. And that was one of my top 4 biggest fears, was losing a limb or being paralyzed. And I remember when they told me that, my first thought was like, I'm going to be okay. And I meant that to my core. And, you know, and we've had, I remember we went to Maui a couple years back, and a couple meth addicts decided they wanted to live in our house for a week. We were gone on vacation and, you know, lived in our home, stole my girlfriend's car, broke a lot of stuff in our house. It was pretty crazy. But when the woman came back to our house and we had her arrested, we had enough presence of mind and enough love for a fellow alcoholic that we gave her a big book and we gave her, you know, some warm clothes, because I know what the Marin County Jail looks like, and it's not a warm place. You know, there's no fireplace in the Marin County Jail. I know that from experience. And the inverse is true. You know, my life could go seemingly well. I could have all the success in the world, and I could be living in fear, and I'm sick again. And, you know, this next shoe's going to drop. The sky is falling. And, you know, fear is one of those things where if I allow one area to come in, it just like, it's like taking that first drink. You know, fear just comes in all these other areas of my life, and it becomes more and more irrational, but then it becomes more and more real. And then I start making decisions based off that fear. And that's when that unmanageability just skyrockets. You know, I love AA. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a good life today I have a great life today. And that's the honest truth. And as long as I keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, continue to inventory these things and stay current with a loving higher power, I'm confident that it's going to be that way. So I appreciate you guys having me come out and share today, and ask me to participate. Thanks.